Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Hey, we're back on The Farkas Files. Thanks so much for being with us. Thursday, as always, I have a wonderful guest who's doing some fascinating work. Mark C. Brown is a PhD in psychology who has been studying enlightenment and has some fascinating ideas. And we'll be talking to him in just a minute. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing, which for a number of reasons is about cars. If you've been listening and reading my website, you know that I have this catchphrase of everything is energy, everything is connected, everything is conscious, and everything is interactive. So this weekend, I got a newer car. You know, it's a used car. It's a 2002 Forester. But I was replacing a 1997 RAV4, which I've had for 12 years. So my RAV4 was an old friend. And like lots of old friends, it had its good points and its bad points, its comfortable aspects and its less than comfortable aspects. But it was a really good friend. And, you know, when you do mystical kinds of stuff, you talk to everything because everything's conscious. And there is a response, and sometimes you can get a feeling or something comes into your head. And I found saying goodbye to my car, who had been a good companion for 12 years, was in many ways really hard. It was like letting go of a friend. And, you know, with people, you see them again, you can call them on the phone, you'll find out whether they're okay, you can, you know, check in with them on Facebook or whatever. But what do you do with an old friend like your car? And that was a really interesting process. And then there's the process of getting to know the new car. And, you know, what does it want to be called? What's its name? What does it do? How is it different? Everything is a relationship. Everything is an energetic relationship. Everything is a communication. So for some of you, you know, you may be hearing this for the first time and it sounds a little out there. Well, a lot of what I say sounds a little out there. On the other hand, it gives you a different way of looking at things. I had an aunt who, before I knew anything about this, I would just watch what she did, and she talked to everything. She just spent her day talking to everything she interacted with. She talked not just to animals and trees, but to the dishes while she washed them and the coffee pot while she was making coffee and everything. She just had an ongoing conversation, not expecting any response that I was aware of, but she knew that her words and her thoughts were having an effect on her environment. And she, when nobody else was listening, just had that conversation going on. So I encourage you to tune into things in a different way, to give respect to everything, as we have learned from every indigenous culture, but especially for the things that you consider things who are your good friends, your car, your laptop, you know, your favorite chair, all those things that in many ways are part of you and part of your energy and that you would really miss deeply. Say thank you. And think about what life would be like without them. So that's my metaphysical musing for this evening. And now we get to have some fun with Mark Brown. You there, Mark?
I am here.
Fantastic. I really appreciate you being on today. I understand you're feeling a little punky, so.
Got a cold that just really took over today, but I think I'm up to this. I just hope I don't sound too stuffy.
Well, you know, there are people that sound stuffy and they don't have colds, so.
That's right, for sure.
And my guess is that you are not that kind of stuffy at all.
I'm not a stuffy person.
Right. So, you know, I looked at some of your background information. You're doing just fascinating stuff. You're a psychologist who has been fascinated with enlightenment for a long time, and you've kind of created the intersection of the two where you're doing research about enlightenment, and you have some very high-tech ways of teaching meditation and studying the effects of meditation. You also have a fascinating book. So why don't we start a little bit with your background and how you got interested in enlightenment and meditation and how things moved from there?
Well, for probably half of my career, I was a fairly conventional psychologist. And then I went through a huge life change that just really threw me out of my usual way of thinking about things. And what was interesting is the literature that I would normally recommend to people going through divorce wasn't helpful to me at all, because it seemed to me the divorce process was about much more than just getting out of a marriage you're unhappy with. And I just started gravitating to Eastern literature. I had a brother who had already been reading that and was a meditator, and he introduced me to some of that. And I loved it. To me, it began to talk about life in a way that really appealed to me. If you're going to go through a huge change and all the pain, and you're going to cause pain for other people, then if it has meaning, if it seems to have a purpose, if there's some kind of progression in your life because of it, it all begins to make more sense. And that's what happened for me. So then the past 20 years, I've been reading that literature, and one thing I started was EEG biofeedback, which is a brainwave biofeedback. It's brain training using computers. And what I learned in doing this is to think about meditation in a physical way. It's a physiological process, not some mystical, strange process, magical process where people go into an altered state and stay there. It's really a matter of changing by way of a breathing technique, the oxygen and carbon dioxide balance in your brain, which causes the brainwave frequencies, the dominant ones, to shift from the higher frequencies that we use to drive in traffic or, do our taxes, to the lower ones that are very relaxing for us.
So this is more like going into alpha, theta, delta.
You're exactly experience. Right. It's downshifting from beta dominance to alpha and even lower into theta. And, with practice, people can do that. And the value of EEG biofeedback is that the program tells your brain when it's producing alpha and theta, and it inhibits the higher frequencies in the process. So the whole thing happens a lot faster.
So what's the feedback mechanism? So the EEG is collecting that information, but how is it fed back to the person meditating?
In this program is called Alpha Theta, which makes sense because that's what we're training Alpha and Theta. And what the computer does is it gives two different sounds, Tibetan bowl for Theta and a chime for Alpha. So when your brain produces, just by searching around in there trying to figure out how to do this, when it hits on those frequencies, it gets the sound. And when it gets that sound, then it encourages it to do more of that. Brains like feedback.
Mm-hmm. It's an approach that's almost coming from the opposite direction of I don't want to mention a proprietary system, but the systems that are involved in using tones in the ears to get the brain to entrain to a particular frequency.
I know what you're talking about. What I do, EEG biofeedback, is not actually entrainment.
Right.
It reads what the brain produces and then rewards the brain for producing that. Entrainment
tries to get
the brain to produce it.
Right. You actually have the biofeedback. You can measure the brain waves and feed it back. The other system is creating a tone that the brain entrains on to get to those frequencies.
Yes.
So you're coming at it from almost the opposite direction.
Yes.
And do you find that people can learn to meditate more quickly or more deeply? What are the advantages to learning it that way rather than a standard way of learning meditation or using the audio tapes?
Well, the advantage is that every time, every 2 seconds, the brain's reinforced for producing alpha and theta. So there's constant feedback. So it's sort of a classroom for the brain. And when you're meditating on your own, there isn't that kind of feedback. You might get into a comfortable state, but your brain doesn't know that it's what it's actually doing. So with practice, you can get better at it. But what I know is that experienced meditators who undertake EEG biofeedback talk about how quickly and deeply they meditate and how it advances them faster than they ever advanced before. So it's the feedback. That's what really works.
Right. Right. As somebody who does a lot of healing work and, you know, I do intake interviews over the phone, I don't know what brain state I'm in, but I know when I shift.
Uh-huh.
Partly because as soon as I start doing the psychic work, I can no longer do math.
Yes, that makes sense.
You know, if somebody asks me how much it's going to cost, I have to pull out the calculator for the simplest arithmetic because my brain just can't do it.
Yeah, you're getting into a very different space. The,
right.
The higher
right.
frequencies are for calculations. You're probably in more in theta. Theta right. is where this healing occurs.
Right. So, you know, it's not the deeper state that I use when I'm actually doing healing work. I don't have to go that deep to do the scanning.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely a shift where some brain functions don't work. Other brain functions are heightened dramatically. And, you know, I've been doing it a long time, so I can do it with still being conscious and carrying on a conversation.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
For most people, they would be much quieter than I am. Mm-hmm. I've never been good at being quiet.
You have the right job.
Which is right, which is good for radio hosts.
Yes.
So are you also studying the psychology of how people are affected by the meditation?
Well, it's something I pick up over time. So, yes, it's not like I make a formal study of that literature. It's something you learn along with EEG biofeedback, especially if you're taking training in alpha-theta work. But the changes, and I think this is really important, and it's really a theme in my book, and actually it picks up on what you were saying about talking to things. And that is that rather than thinking about these as mystical, unusual processes, we need to think about them as natural, conscious, sort of everyday processes, because that's what they are. And this business about talking to things, for example. This book talks in terms of evolution from the very first instant of creation all the way through material evolution to the development of the self and self-awareness and higher consciousness and enlightened awareness. And all of the higher states are extensions of the lower states. It's something we typically don't think about. We think somehow we're just, you know, magically superior to those, but they are absolutely connected to us. So if they weren't there, we wouldn't have awareness at all. And, you know, the sense of spirituality people have, if it wasn't for that physical base, that wouldn't be there at all either.
Well, I have a different perspective. Shall I give you my different perspective and we can kick it around?
Okay.
To me, the idea that everything is energy is really confirmed by quantum physics and mm-hmm. a lot of cosmology at this point that's saying there's something there. We don't know. There is no scientific way of measuring it yet, but the effects are becoming well known. And actually in the former Soviet Union and in Russia, they've been doing a lot of hard science about fields, and they have different ways of explaining it and different names for it. There are studies that I've read that show that people with hydroencephaly, so better known as water on the brain, whose brain tissue has been pushed aside by the liquid, sometimes to the point where the description was, it's like a slice of bologna against the skull. There's basically no brain matter left. Most of them, something like 75% of them, don't survive. But of the survivors, a few of them are extremely high functioning, including at least one, if not more, physicists who do high level math, essentially with no brain, which is a confirmation that the brain is a processing center for a function that is part of that larger field that connects everything, and that it all is really happening in the field, and the brain is just the location where we can see the processing happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I've run across some other things that, you know, whether there's enough science there to say that you can come up with a good hypothesis, I don't know, but there's enough anecdotal evidence to say, yeah, you know, you can't really just look at the physical with anything. There's something larger going on. And so from my perspective, both my personal experience and this strange stuff I like to read, the medical model or anything that's looking only at what's going on in an organ is looking at an intermediate step, which is very useful. Obviously, you're learning tremendous things and you're giving people a new tool and there's all this wonderful stuff. But I think there really is something, if you want to call that energy field spirituality, that sense of connectedness to whatever the matrix of all information in the universe is, or however you want to say that, that that matrix really exists and people can connect to it. And that through meditation, you wind up in a state where you can sense it. That making sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. We're not talking differently at all, really.
Right.
The everything is made up of energy, of course, and it you start with energy, and by way of consciousness. And what I think the way my book talks about this, the way this book talks about it, is that what you would be describing, maybe what you're describing, is what the book would call consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And consciousness is, it's what initiated creation, and we don't know how that happened. It's
right.
A mystery, but it is what caused everything in creation to evolve as it did, it never changing its original form, which you might think about in spiritual terms. Even though there are, you know, there's matter and there are shapes, but as it progressed, then this awareness that somebody with a damaged brain, a hydrocephalic person, for example, has, there's probably enough brain there for this consciousness to move on to higher awareness, and as mm-hmm. it does that, then it's capable of doing those higher processes you're talking about.
Right, right. I find all of it totally fascinating because the same is true with disease processes. There are a lot of different approaches which make the assumption that there is an emotional or belief system component to any disease that happens in the body. And you can call that a stressful event. You can, you know, look at it lots of different ways. You know, in doing your research and your work about divorce, and I went through a divorce 7 years ago, you know, it's very common for people not only to be depressed, but also to either injure themselves or get some kind of illness that's really annoying and takes longer to let go of. You know, it shows up in a lot of different ways where it's really common and everyone goes, oh, yeah, he's under stress. But there are systems that have kind of mapped that out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the stuff you're doing is fascinating. I mean, I would love to see the stuff about the brain scans.
Well, there has to be enough of a base for it serves as a platform for the next level of development, right, or the next level of expression of consciousness. So, you know, how much that would be, what would be required, what parts of the brain, you know, if they developed would be enough, that I'm not sure about. I have not looked at that at all. But I would assume there would have to be enough, A, to survive, but then B, for the higher processes mm-hmm. to develop.
Well, how do you define enlightenment, and how do you see the process of enlightenment? What does that mean in the context of how you look at this stuff?
Well, formally in this book, enlightenment is the progression of consciousness beyond the context of the self, or in other words, the world of I am. Informally, it is pretty literally a process of becoming lighter, lightening up, not allowing the drama of everyday life to weigh consciousness down. We participate in this process by learning meditation, for example, and using our ability to watch ourselves, to be aware of ourselves, use that to watch everything that comes into consciousness, basic fears, desires, worries, things that we might have learned by way of social conditioning. Mm-hmm. And rather than allowing them to attach and take our consciousness along with them, to allow them to pass, just arise and pass as if moving through an open window, that's mm-hmm. That's a way of finding inner peace, finding peace with the world. In mm-hmm. this book is a matter of working like a mirror, which allows you to not interject yourself into what goes on out there. You allow what's out there, the way people are, world events, to be just as they are, not as you might wish them to be.
Right. Well, tell us the title of the book again. You did, but it was kind of in passing.
The book is called Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And so we're talking a little bit at this point about the live like a window side of that.
Correct. And working like a mirror. Yes. Yes.
So it's kind of like any basic meditation technique where you're noticing what's going on and not being attached to it and letting it just pass through.
Letting it pass through, yes.
But making it an in-the-moment, all-the-time, every day, every-minute kind of process.
All the time. And you know, taking that formal time out, because we tend to do it better at those times. Although, once you learn meditation, the idea is that you would take it into your life and that it would serve you in that very way. And
right. As
we allow things just to pass, that's where we find serenity.
Right. Right. And, you know, I totally agree with the way you're describing it and the process, although, you know, there are other letting go techniques that I've learned along the way that I tend to use, but it's exactly the same stuff.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure people know that our guest tonight is Mark C. Brown, who is a psychologist, a PhD, and his book is Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness. And why don't you give your website? We'll give it again a couple of times, but I want to make sure people know where to find you.
Okay, it's Mark with a K, markcbrown.com.
Mm-hmm.
There's a brief introductory video about the book, some good blogs, interesting and helpful blogs, and an easy way to get a print version or ebook version of the book.
Very cool. Very cool. We've got a couple of minutes to the break. So just quickly, you moved from the process of looking at Eastern philosophy and meditation in a stressful time for you and writing a book about that to writing this book. Did this book kind of come out of your experimentation with the biofeedback?
No, actually, the book was a complete surprise to me. I have stories similar to the one you talked about with your car, awareness coming through mechanical things. Or my wife's a medium, my office manager's a medium, I have a couple neighbors who are mediums. It's like I couldn't throw a rock without hitting a medium. So, you know, that whole side of consciousness is something that's really familiar to me. But I had no idea about writing a book. The first one took so much time. It was so hard. I really had no idea about writing another one. But one Sunday summer morning, I went out on the porch with my usual cup of coffee, but instead of a crossword puzzle, I went out with a legal pad. And, you know, I can't explain why, but for the next 2 weeks, I filled 4 legal pads with what is the title and the contents of this book. Story. And it was new material to me, so I had to spend a lot of time with it.
Hold the thought, because we're going to have some messages. And on the other side of the messages, we'll be back with Mark C. Brown here on Empower Radio. Don't go anywhere. Join us, and you'll be able to call in, too.
This week's episode, Fire at the Shed.
Gee, Johnny, this rope swing sure is swell.
Don't I know it.
Hey, it's Sassy. I think she's trying to tell us something. Mr. Gunderson? What about Mr. Gunderson? A fire? Mr. Gunderson's trapped?
Where, Sassy? Where?
What, Sassy? Now that you've got our attention, you'd like to take a moment to talk about shelter pets? Shelter pets in general are well-adjusted, healthy, and love being with people?
Sassy, we don't have time!
Pets often end up in shelters due to owner problems like divorce or allergies?
That's great, Sassy, but what about the fire?
There is no fire! You're just messing with our heads?
Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the Shelter Pet Project.
If your walls could
remember,
talk,
adopt.
What would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Hi, Dad.
Hey, sweetheart. Where's the little guy? In school?
Yep, just dropped him off. Is your hair getting whiter, or is that paint?
Actually, I'm painting your old room.
Did you take down my David Cassidy posters?
Nah, I painted over them.
Dad!
Just kidding.
Why were you painting my old room?
You had a purple room.
Moby Grape.
Well, your mom and I are upsizing. We're hosting a foreign exchange student from Cairo.
What about me and your grandson?
Come on, it'll be a great experience for everybody.
We'll never see you. You'll be taking her to the museum and the zoo and...
Sweetheart, you know how great it'll be for my grandson to experience another culture. He could learn another language, new customs.
I never thought of that. Got an extra paintbrush?
The time is now. Open up your life. Find out how to have a foreign exchange student live with you. Every family has something special to share. Go to hoststudents.org. That's hoststudents.org.
Imagine my grandson speaking Arabic.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
We're back with Mark C. Brown. I'm talking about his fascinating research and his book. I want to give the call-in number so that people who are lurking there in the background can call and ask questions and join the conversation. That number is 248-809-3474. 248-809-3474. So, Mark, you know, you were talking about inspiration striking and the book kind of, as some people would say, writing itself. I think other people would probably call it channeling, but, you know, it's all just another word for inspiration. Tell me about that experience, because that's exciting stuff.
Well, it was pretty amazing, actually, because I'd sit on the porch and I would write a line. The title, for example, I started writing it, and I stopped, and I said, what does that even mean? And, you know, I just stuck with the process and wrote all this stuff down. And I'd be talking to my wife as, you know, I was doing this. I'd say, hey, listen to this. You know, as if somebody was, well, and somebody was, I'm sure, was downloading this information to me, and I was sharing it then with her. But it was different enough from anything I had seen that I spent weeks and weeks going over it, reading it, sorting it out before I could even begin to write a book. And a lot of what was in it I learned in writing the book, and then in, actually I've read the book 17 times now, I'm starting my 18th time. And, you know, there's a depth to it that is thrilling to me. And my other book was based on my work as a psychologist and my experience in divorce. This was not based on anything like that. This really is, it's an inspired book. So inspiration is the right word. If, you know, I think of it as a download.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something, I didn't sit down and do an outline of the book. There was nothing like that going on. It doesn't reference any other books. It doesn't reference the usual terminology you see in books like this or any belief systems or anything like that. So for me, it's really totally fresh.
And, you know, what you're describing is a typical mystical or shamanic experience of sitting and having information that, you know, while there may be a part of you that understands it, you know, is not coming in your voice in the way that you would put thoughts together. You don't have enough background information to be putting this thing together this way.
Even though I'd read the literature for 20 years, I could have.
Right.
I wasn't qualified to write this book.
Right. I have a friend who tells me I should wear a digital recorder all the time because there's no telling what will come out of my mouth. And I frequently, in the middle of doing a talk, will say, that was interesting. Where'd that come from? I've never heard that before.
And you may wish you had recorded it.
Well, I've learned that anytime I'm speaking in front of a group of people, I've got a recorder running.
Good.
For exactly that reason, because whether it's a synthesis in my brain, your brain, you know, our consciousness of all of that stuff that we've taken in, and when that person asks the right question, or you're posing the question to yourself,
yes.
that it comes together, mm-hmm. or whether the fact that you're asking the questions draws that information out of consciousness, the matrix, you know, however you want to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
That field of all information that suddenly you've accessed something that was not accessible to you before.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most exciting things there is. And of course, in the DSM-4, which is the diagnostic manual for what kind of crazy you are, there are diagnoses for this experience.
Well, you know, people are fortunate when they come to see people who understand things from a different perspective and can sort it out. You know, what's this kind of experience and what may be a true mental health issue?
Right.
Otherwise, they could end up on pretty powerful medications when
which
you know, what they have to say is actually very, very important.
Shuts down all the stuff that you're getting. Salvador Dali had this wonderful statement he made, which was the only difference between me and a crazy person in a psych hospital, which sounds much better in French, is that I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
You know, that I have all this stuff going on which could overwhelm me, but it's not overwhelming me. I'm using it.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand what it's like to be considered so different that people would think you're crazy. And I've always loved that quote.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about the other side of the title, the Work Like a Mirror.
Working Like a Mirror is a way of finding peace in relationships and in relation to the rest of the world. And the idea would be you holding a perfectly clear looking glass in front of you so that everything in front of it only reflects itself. That way, you're not projecting any of yourself into what's going on out there. And that good for people you're in relationships with, because they get to see who they are, not who you want them to be. But it also allows you to get the idea that what goes on in the world is really not about you. It's about whatever is going on out there. The practical side of that is, if you can do that, you can still participate in the world. You can do healing work, for example, or sales work or whatever. But you don't have to have the world behave the way you want it to. It doesn't have to, for example, line up just the way you need it so that you can feel secure or relaxed, because that's work you're doing from the inside. So working like a mirror is the interpersonal and sort of the interactive with the world side of becoming a serene person, and of living like a window.
So, and we'll say that last part again, because I think it kind of got swallowed, living like an adult.
Well, you know, living like an adult can be a lot of things, but it's living from within. It's using that same self-awareness, that observational ability we have to watch our reactions to what goes on out there and not react to that anymore. Allow it just to be as it is. And, you know, stuff is, what you see is that things that are occurring now that you think are terrible and, you know, never happened before, have always happened. So There's stuff going on in the world that has always happened before. If we keep reacting to it as if it's different or new, we'll always be disturbed. Actually, that's part of, to me, in this book, you know, the book doesn't refer to me at all. I'm not in this book. It's not about It's not about my opinions or anything. But the idea of higher consciousness is just sort of what I'm talking about. It's getting that bigger picture of things, being able to step away and seeing all things being connected, just as you were talking about earlier, but also seeing that none of this is new, and none of it really has to do with us, and that we can leave it alone if what we're after is being peaceful people.
Right. You know, I'm getting what you're saying. I'm trying to formulate my sense of another aspect to it. You know, a lot of what I do feels like, looks like a struggle between light and dark. Light and dark forces. And I can be in that state of being a mirror and watching it and saying, this has happened before, and these are the same things that have been going on before. But there's also a part of me that knows that I'm creating everything in the universe, that my consciousness and my thoughts and my emotions and my thoughts have influence. So if I'm totally at rest and totally at peace with things that I see as being dangerous or destructive, I'm not creating the reality that I want. So one of the phrases that goes through my head a lot is, not on my watch. If I know about it, if I'm conscious of it, then there's a part of me that's creating it. So being at peace is my part of letting go of my part of creating it. On the other hand, there's part of me that takes a more guardian warrior position and says, I know which side of this struggle I'm on, and I'm going to do my part. Now, you can do that with humor, and you can do that from a peaceful place, I think. You know, if you watch the Dalai Lama and talk about the struggles of Tibet, you see that kind of consciousness of, you know, he is a very powerful spiritual leader who is at peace with what's going on, and he's going to fight for the autonomy of his people and how his people are treated. So I don't know that you can do the good fight without approaching being at peace. So I totally agree with you there. And on the other side, being totally in that peaceful place and accepting everything doesn't give you the power that we've all been given. That making sense?
Well, yeah, it does make sense. We have the ability to participate actively in life without reacting to what we're participating in. And it's not an easy skill to develop because by nature, you know, we tend to look at things as good and evil. And we, you know, if we're nurturing at all, we tend to react in protective ways. The window approach is one in which all reactions, regardless of what they are allowed to be, to come up, and we watch them and we let them pass. That doesn't mean that we would be passive in life. We can still go about doing good work. It's that business about quieting our brains so they don't get into those higher ranges where people get angry.
Right.
Now, you know, if that's where somebody is and they define their meaning in life by, you know, intervening from an angry sort of powerful way, then I would have no argument with that. The idea of living like a window, working like a mirror, is that you can participate in life, but you don't have to have things the way you want them to be. You don't have to react the way people react. That way, regardless of what goes on, you can still find inner peace.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. It makes sense. The image of the mirror is fascinating to me because in the kind of work that I do, putting up a metaphoric mirror, in effect, bounces whatever the person is trying to do, especially if it's something negative, back to them. I call it a karma accelerator. You know, it's like, oh, you're putting out all this dark stuff here. How would you like it? You know, just put a mirror up and let it go back to them. And so you're adding that peacefulness on the one side of the mirror as if it was a two-way mirror where you can just look through it and see all of it as a reflection of what everybody is doing. But I think in some ways that mirror image is actually even more powerful.
Well, the two-way mirror is, that's a good way of expressing it. You know, what happens on the other side is all reflection. And even though you're involved because you're looking through it and communicating through it, none of you gets reflected in the process. None of it's reflected back. So it's a way of having sort of a pure relationship with somebody where it really is all about that person, even though you may be making observations and giving input and doing healing work.
In effect, the perfect therapeutic relationship as well. It's what therapists at their best are capable of doing, not putting any of their stuff into it and being able to reflect things back to somebody who's under stress.
Yeah, our job is to share our observations, and you know, how we do that is as far as becoming lighter, becoming enlightened, you know, that's the heart of our being able to participate in something that's important without getting stirred up by it in a way that, you know, that drags us in.
Right.
We think about it a lot, and, you know, we can't let go of it, and our peace is disturbed.
And you're drained, and you're stressed, and
Yeah, people can burn out that way. So it isn't at all about not participating. It's about participating in a different way.
So how long did it take for all this stuff to download and put the book together? This is part of me who has about three books sitting there yelling at me to get rid of it.
It's hard work. You know, the download was literally 2 weeks. And then it stopped. And then I sat at, you know, in my kitchen, and I got smaller sheets of paper, and I started sorting these things out in categories. Actually, I sorted them sort of in an evolutionary sense, starting with the lower chakras and working my way up. And I spent many weeks doing that. And then it took I don't know, it took a month or so to write the first paragraph. Mm-hmm. But once I got that done, once I started, the writing the book actually only took 6 months.
Which is
my other
impressive.
One took 2 years.
Yeah, which
so
is
I was
impressive.
Done from download to completion, it was like 10 months, I'd say.
That's a
and
pretty
it's a,
amazing.
I'm telling you,
pretty
it's
amazing.
A terrific book. It's,
yeah.
I am so happy with it, and I get so much out of it rereading. And the feedback from people is just the same, that it's a life-changing kind of thing. So, you know, it's a real gift for everybody. And my part in it was my hard work in writing it in a way that would make all these ideas accessible to people.
It's, you know, when I hear somebody say I read my own book over and over again and I get something out of it, that's always impresses me. Because you can really see that there was no ego in it, that there was something that got put down there and you can learn from it too.
That's exactly right. My previous book I read once, you know, sort of a proofreading thing when it was done, but and it's a good book. People like it and they find it helpful. But it's not a book I would learn from because it's stuff I already knew. This is different
right.
from that.
Right. I want to give the call-in number one more time. We've only got about 10 minutes, but there may be some folks that have questions. It's 248-809-3474. 248-809-3474. Got a question? Want to make a comment? Let's take a few minutes and do that. So what's next for you? Because you're doing some fascinating things. What's your focus now?
Well, it really is reading and rereading this book and really getting a handle on it so that I can present it to other people, as I am on your show tonight. So it's actually only been out for a month.
Oh, wow.
So now I'm in the promotional
yes.
process. So that, and that is, besides my work in my psychology practice, this is pretty time-consuming.
Right.
And since I'm not a natural at this, you sound like you are. it takes a lot of energy for me to get this done right.
Yeah, somebody said the qualities of an enlightened person are that they have a smile on their face, like they get a joke that nobody else gets, mm-hmm. and they don't say much.
Yes, yes.
So I figure I'm only halfway there.
Yeah, I think of myself as a journeyman. I am really, really grateful for this download because it helped me understand something that I never could quite grasp. People would talk about enlightenment as if it's some mystical, wonderful state that only a few people participate in, but it's actually something that's built into our nature and
right.
Everyone's eventual destiny. And it's right. something that's completely understandable. It's pure observation. It's our ability to stand back, watch what's going on, and actually watch ourselves watching what's going on so that we become, even though we're living our lives, we become observers. We're participant observers in it. It's not something so special after all.
Well, one of the fascinating things I heard in a lecture at one point, we have somebody who with a question. So let's see who's here. Jim from North Carolina. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
You're yeah, hi.
You I have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I'd like to hear your opinion and Dr. Brown's opinion about the aspect of his book, the mirror aspect of it and how that might relate to the ideas and discussions about the possibility of parallel universes that, could perfectly line up with our universe, with our experience as it is, and if there could be any kind of influence, perhaps, from one realm to the other by way of, energy connections. And that, if this idea of lining mirrors up perfectly could somehow be expanded to, you know, parallel universes being lined up perfectly in some way, reflecting what's going on somewhere else. Just a kind of a curious question.
Fascinating question. Thanks so much, Jim.
That's sure. If you don't mind, that's all yours, David. This book doesn't address that at all.
Yeah, my understanding of what Mark came up with is using the metaphor of the mirror as a way of saying that you're not going to interact with somebody else's emotions and process, that you're going to just look at it as a reflection of them and not get caught up. And you're going to be self-contained and quiet in yourself, and supportive of them, but realize that all their stuff is their stuff. Now, I could get into all kinds of fascinating things about parallel universes, including the idea that that space-time where we live, you know, we think that if there's a parallel universe, it'll be another version of space-time. And I get the sense that space-time, whatever this illusion is, because time doesn't exist, and there are all kinds of problems with trying to figure out what actually we're experiencing, is a very small subset, some kind of dimension to itself, of that larger energy field that we talked about as consciousness, or the matrix of all information, where the other stuff comes from. Could there be lots of them? Lots of different versions of space-time? Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that physicists are talking about at this point. The physicists are starting to sound crazier than the mystics at this point. But I think that for me, in the way that I see some of this stuff, because a lot of what I do is very visual, that there is a quality, a different kind of graininess, a different geometry to stuff that's non-physical compared to stuff that's physical. But even the physical stuff is some kind of illusion. It's all energy. So are there parallel universes? There are things that are best explained at the moment by saying the possibility exists of parallel universes and we're interacting with them. Do we know right now? Obviously not, and I don't have a really good take on it. So, but that's a fascinating question. Huh? So, Mark, I just want to make sure again that people know where to find you and where to get the book. So,
a good thing to do is to go to my website, markcbrown.com. There's, as I said, an introductory video to the book. It's very brief. And there are blogs I've written, a lot of them really excerpts from the book or adaptations from the book that are very interesting, that would give people an idea of what's there. And then there are links to Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, where a print book or an e-version can be ordered.
Terrific. Terrific. And no new books on the horizon? You're just going to do...
No. You know what? It would have to come the way this one came. It would have to be the same. In fact, that's what
question.
I said about after my first one. I said, a muse is going to have to sit on my shoulder and talk into my ear.
And that's exactly what you got.
That's exactly what happened. So I didn't know this was coming. If there's another one coming, I don't know about it.
All righty. Well, you know, it's a terrible thing to ask somebody who's on a book tour anyway.
That's right.
Because I have a little bit of an idea of how intense that promotional stuff can be. Mark, thank you so much, especially since it was kind of a last-minute arrangement here, and I know you weren't feeling well. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for
your work. Your work is fascinating. I'd love to talk to you some more. And but not tonight, because we're running out of time.
Good.
So I just want to make sure people know where to find me. You can find information about my work at househealing.com. And between now and the end of the month, we're doing something we never tried before. If you buy one of my services, you'll get a second one free. We're doing a BOGO promotion. So go take a look at that. It's in the events section on my blog. If you're interested, this is a really good time to check it out. We will be back next week, and actually, I was going to tell you something else, but I don't have the information in front of me, and I hate when that happens. So, we will be here again next week, as we always are, on the Farkas Files. I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and tell your friends, tell your relatives. We have a good time here talking about all kinds of interesting and phantasmagorical stuff. So, again, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. And my name is David Franklin Farkas, and I approve this message.